Hello and welcome to the Radio Thrift Shop with DJ Frederick. From folk to rock, old jazz and new releases, in all genres, you'll hear it on the Radio Thrift Shop, celebrating 78s, 33s, 45s, tapes of all sorts, and even compact discs. Radio Thrift Shop is analog culture for a digital world. A little bit later in the program, we're going to hear part two of a documentary around the telharmonium, an amazing electronic musical instrument that was invented at the turn of the 20th century. First, we're going to dig into some amazing music by Brundlefly and the Swede from their 2013 release, Cabin Music.
If I had ever been here before, I would probably know just what to do. Don't you? If I had ever been here before, another time around the wheel, I would probably know just how to deal with all of you.
Thank you so much.
A beautiful rendition of Deja Vu by Crosby, Pivar, and Raymond. And before that, we heard Brundlefly and the Swede from their Cabin Music release, which was released on compact disc, vinyl, and cassette tape. We heard Side C, which is available only on cassette tape. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. Right now, it's time for part two of a documentary series that I've been airing here on the Thrift Shop called Magic Music from the Telharmonium. The Telharmonium was an early electronic organ developed by Thaddeus Cahill in 1897. The electric signal from the Telharmonium was transmitted over wires and heard on the receiving end by means of horn speakers like very early radio. So here's part two, Magic Music from the Telharmonium.
Telharmonium service to the Cafe Martin on Madison Square was inaugurated in November 1906. The foyer of this elegant Parisian establishment attracted ladies who, for professional reasons, seldom disdained invitations to an evening's diversion. At first, the F-sharps from the Telharmonium blared shrilly. A defective diaphragm was quickly replaced. And it seemed to the delighted patrons that clearly here was an instrument that would purvey music to the million. After the cafe's inaugural dinner, the honored guests repaired to Telharmonic Hall. Here they were treated to a demonstration of the singing arc, two arc lamps connected directly to the Telharmonium. As they glowed with light, the lamps acted as small loudspeakers, oscillating with music. Early in December, Mark Twain visited Telharmonic Hall.
Every time I see or hear a new wonder like this, I have to postpone my death right off. I couldn't possibly leave the world until I've heard this again and again.
Just after New Year's Day, the New York Electric Music Company connected the Telharmonium to the massive, ornate, and ostentatious Casino Theater. The casino was a luxurious temple for fluffy and frolicsome musical productions. It was the primary gathering place where privileged young men could survey a showcase of feminine bloom. For an hour before the curtain rose on the huge chorus, the pretty and shapely women, and the bubbling gaiety, audiences were delighted with the Telharmonium. The electrical music was piped into the gilded lobby before the musical comedies and during the intermissions.
Sweet, rounding music. Great, penetrating power.
In January 1907, Telharmonic Hall finally announced that concerts would be open to the public. A long list of distinguished guests attended the gala formal reception. Present were composer Victor Herbert, banker Spencer Trask, financier George Foster Peabody, conductor Walter Damrosch, playwright Clyde Fitch, and inventor Peter Cooper Hewitt. Crosby grandly announced that the Hotel Normandy on Broadway and 38th Street and the magnificent Waldorf Astoria on 5th Avenue and 33rd had just subscribed to his Telharmonic service.
tones.
Inside Telharmonic Hall, music played from horns hidden in the circular divan, the ceiling, ferns and shrubs, columns and urns. The prestigious Elliot Schenck was named the new music director and replaced the little-known and expendable Edwin Hall Pierce. With 9 pieces at each of 4 daily concerts, it became difficult for the musicians to find enough time to practice, and it wasn't long before the quality of performances became inconsistent. Meanwhile, Thaddeus Cahill plodded on in Holyoke, working on improvements. February 1907 was the heyday of the Telharmonium. At the unveiling, critics had noted that Telharmonic music was deficient.
Rather crude and lacking in variety, also certain tones are over-accented.
Yet, in the space of a few weeks, it had become a popular novelty, and hundreds filled Telharmonic Hall for each concert. The New York newspapers daily carried glowing reports. The hall featured exciting demonstrations of tone building, the sounds of the different acoustic instruments as they were built up from scratch. Vocalists sang, and a violinist played along with the instrument in the hall, but at first, only the keyboard music was transmitted over the wires. After a few weeks, Broadway singer Isabel Winlock was hired to record gramophone records for the telephone transmission of vocals along with the telharmonium.
A blend of woodwind and brass with a peculiar twang of zone.
Many of the new hotels purchased the service, the Victoria on Broadway and 27th, and the Imperial on Broadway and 31st among them. The latter was the site of the great Telharmonic Lenten Revival service, led by the Reverend Henry Marsh Warren. As the good preacher announced the hymns in the hotel meeting room, the performer at Telharmonic Hall was cued to begin by telephone. At a simultaneous service at Telharmonic Hall, the hymns were sung and transmitted to the subscribing hotels.
When the musical redeemer comes, he will be able, by means of the telharmonic system, to draw unimagined harmonies from the caves of sound.
Lee DeForest was an ambitious young inventor who had been experimenting with radio transmissions for 6 years. He had just invented the 3-element vacuum tube, the triode, or audion. In February 1907, he persuaded a skeptical Oscar T. Crosby to let him broadcast the telharmonium. He set up his radio receiver on the roof of the Yale Club, an 11-story building on 44th Street. The electrical music would come through the air, but so would interference in the form of Morse code from steamships in the harbor. Next, DeForest put his apparatus on the top floor of the Times Tower, a skyscraper on 43rd Street. But accompanying the music were radio telegraph signals from the Brooklyn Navy Yard and as far away as Bridgeport, Connecticut. DeForest continued broadcasting from Telharmonic Hall for several months, but static, dropouts, and frying noises made reception undependable. DeForest nevertheless tried to peddle his system to the New York Electric Music Company, but Crosby declined. In April, the hall announced the end of its first season. The final program was a multi-channel extravaganza featuring different sounds from various locations in the auditorium. Portable volume controls were carried through the audience, and the enchanted patrons were invited to operate them.
A sensitive to moods and emotions has a living thing.
Motion pictures demonstrated to potential subscribers how to request musical selections by telephone. After the hall closed, the New York City Board of Estimate offered a cable franchise to Crosby for a hefty $675,000. By the fall of 1907, it had become obvious to Oscar T. Crosby that the Telharmonium would never eliminate traditional instruments and the salaries of those who played them. Rather than throw any more money or time at this white elephant of music, he decided to take his losses and abandoned the Telharmonium. Meanwhile, economic troubles were beginning to fester nationwide. Stock prices fell when the rigid money supply didn't grow with the roaring economy. Soon, commodity prices collapsed. In October, the Knickerbocker Trust Company failed when it was discovered that its directors were loaning the bank's money to themselves. Other banks tumbled in rapid succession, and the panic of 1907 was on. The stock market lost most of its value, and currency was being sold at a premium. Businesses went bankrupt, and 80% of the Broadway shows closed. During the panic, Crosby's junior partner, Frederick C. Todd, took the helm of the New York Electric Music Company. While depositors were withdrawing their money from banks, he formed a new corporation to lure fresh investors and prepared to supply electrical music along Broadway once again.
Exploring science in the sea. Time capsules aren't limited to building cornerstones and the pedestals of statues. Geologists, for example, found one about two-thirds of a mile beneath Chesapeake Bay. Its treasure is the water of the ancient North Atlantic, water that's been cut off from the ocean for more than 100 million years. Chesapeake Bay was gouged out by a mountain-sized space rock that slammed into Earth tens of millions of years ago. The impact squished layers of rock far below the surface. Some of those layers contained seawater that had seeped into the ground. The impact cut off a lake-sized pool of water, isolating it from other water sources and preserving a record of the distant past. In fact, it's the oldest pool of ancient seawater yet discovered. A team of geologists found the water several years ago. The scientists were studying the effects of the impact that created Chesapeake Bay. They were drilling deep into the rocks near Cape Charles, Virginia, near the bay's mouth, when they hit the water. Early measurements showed that it's twice as salty as modern-day seawater. At first, the geologists supposed the water had accumulated the salt from the rocks that encased it. But detailed tests of its chemistry showed otherwise. Among other things, the ratios of certain elements in the water match those of salt formations known to be at least 100 million years old. The scientists described the find as like seawater trapped in amber, a relic of the distant past preserved in a rocky time capsule. Science in the Sea is a production of the University of Texas Marine Science Institute at Port Aransas. I'm Holly Brawley.
You're listening to the Radio Thrift Shop with DJ Frederick. Thank you. We've gotten well into the thrift shop program of our show. That was the Harmonicats with Maria Elena. And before that, Toots Thielman and a tune called Flirt. This is DJ Frederick. You're listening to the Radio Thrift Shop on WSCS 90.9 FM in New London and online at classicalwscs.org. I'm celebrating 15 years on the airwaves here at WSCS and 40 years overall on the airwaves. I started at WUNH way, way back in 1975. If you'd like to communicate with me, I have a new email. It is radiothriftshop@gmail.com. That's radiothriftshop@gmail.com. Bringing the thrift shop into the 21st century. Other than that, we're doing it old school here at the thrift shop. Here's Wes Montgomery. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Set in Vietnam before American troops arrived, when the CIA was stirring the pot for our own ends, the story of the quiet American is told through the eyes of Fowler, played by Michael Caine, a world-weary journalist. He is symbolic of a world that should have been wise enough to see where it was heading. Brendan Fraser plays Pyle, a young American CIA agent on a mission to stir up trouble and conflict by heinous acts which cannot really be justified by any end. Fowler is an old hand. He has served in Vietnam a long time, long enough to fall for the lure of opium and the wiles of a young Vietnamese hostess named Phong. Pyle is new to the country, secure in his idealistic youth, confident that he is on the path of righteousness. He too falls for Phong, who loves neither man. Like her country, she simply endures. The stage is set for a tragedy we can all foresee. The quiet American reeks of symbolism for those who want to look deeply into the mistakes of the past. But the issues are presented within a motion picture that steeps its audience in a complex journey, worthy of the many who suffered its heritage. Indie Film Minute, not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
That's going to wrap up the Radio Thrift Shop for this week with DJ Frederick. Before the break, we heard John Klein and Sid Ramin with the Third Man theme. Before that, Henri René and his orchestra with Whispering. Sir Julian with the Caravan. David Axelrod and Urizen. And we started that set off with Mr. Wes Montgomery and Green Peppers. Well, this is the Radio Thrift Shop program number 240. Join me next week as we take another journey through the dusty aisles of music from the past century of recorded sound. And remember, wherever you are on the planet, take good care of yourself. Take good care of your community. And take good care of those you love.